Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Coming up, your letters and 5 for 5 with Steph Curtis. But first, the perils and the progress in housing and health care for the elderly. If you read the Star Trib series on elder care and abuse, you learned of how many allegations poured into the Department of Health and how few were investigated. Commissioner Jan Malcolm, back for her second go-round as head of MDH and one of our guests today, has made some key changes to improve the system. We're going to talk about that. We're also going to discuss how you can be assured that the shelter and the health care that you're seeking for an aging loved one is as safe as it can be. We want to give you lots of advice on that. So what kinds of questions arise for you as you think about where an elderly family member may go or who you're hiring to provide health care to them? What's the most difficult challenge as you face a decision about care for an aging loved one? Here's the phone number on that, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Jan Malcolm is Commissioner of the Minnesota Health Department. She's in the studio. Welcome. Really good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks
Carrie.
For making time for this. And Chris Sears is a reporter for the Star Trib and wrote the series about elder abuse. And Chris, welcome to you. Really good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
Commissioner, you wrote a commentary as the legislative session ended in which you called out lawmakers for failing to compromise on a standalone bill that you thought would have made a big difference. What kinds of missed opportunities were there there?
Well, thanks, Carrie. I think we're here to talk both about what we have done and need to do to improve our supervisory oversight of long-term care facilities. But one of the really big things we've learned is that there are really important gaps in our regulatory structure in Minnesota. Chris's excellent newspaper series pointed this out. The Office of the Legislative Auditor's report pointed this out. We've fallen behind in Minnesota in not having a really good comprehensive regulatory structure for assisted living facilities and housing with services providers. Nursing homes in Minnesota are very highly regulated, but actually there are fewer people being served in nursing homes today. More and more people are seeking out other forms of living arrangement, which we haven't really kept pace in Minnesota with a regulatory framework for that. So the legislation that Governor Dayton put forward and we were working on all during the session did a number of things. It did seek to improve that regulatory framework. It put resources into things like the Office of the Ombudsman, system improvements at MDH and DHS that are needed to be able to do our regulatory jobs more consistently and more timely, but also really working to clarify what are people's rights in these various care settings and how do they enforce those rights.
Let me ask you about one of the regulatory things that you're talking about, and I think this may apply to a number of listeners. This surprised me in Chris's series that assisted living facilities are not licensed in the state of Minnesota. How unusual is that? And what does that really mean?
That is a key issue. So we have seen a tremendous growth in the numbers of assisted living facilities in Minnesota as the population ages, as people are seeking less regulated care settings. But the problem is there are like no regulations around assisted living. It's a registration process only, which means if you want to open an assisted living facility, you do some paperwork and send in a registration and you're in business.
There's
no licensure.
And no stamp of approval or anything like that.
Correct. Wow. Now, the home care services that are provided within those settings are regulated in various ways, but it gets to be a real maze for consumers for sure, and even for regulators to figure out who's actually responsible for incidents of care going wrong. But as a consumer, protecting our loved ones, which we want to focus on today, it's just really important that we know what is the situation with a care setting that we're thinking about using for our family members. So we now are one of the very few states, and it's a handful of states that don't license assisted living facilities. So that was a key part of the legislative proposal that we were really disappointed did not get included in the legislation that was ultimately rolled into the ill-fated omnibus budget bill. But even as a standalone, right, we were working hard to get assisted living licensure incorporated. We think that's a critical part of fixing this system.
So, Chris, since we are focused today on really giving advice and information to people about how you can be assured that of the quality of the place that your loved one is going or the healthcare or anything like that, did you find that there were easily accessible places of information and data that people could go to say, well, how is this assisted living place performing? Or what can I learn about this nursing home? What was your experience on that?
Absolutely not. No, it was incredibly difficult to get updated, accurate information about, especially about assisted living. You know, you can go online and get information about nursing homes at Nursing Home Compare and get all kinds of inspection reports. But as Commissioner Malcolm pointed out, with assisted living essentially off the grid, it's really difficult to get any kind of information about the health and safety of assisted living facilities, which house about 60,000 Minnesotans. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, that they care for a very vulnerable population. You know, assisted living today is not what it was when it was created, you know, 20, 30 years ago, about 40%.
How so? Yeah.
Well, you know, the latest federal numbers show that, you know, nearly 40% of their residents, at least in Minnesota, have Alzheimer's disease or some other form of dementia. You know, about 60% require assistance with daily activities like bathing and dressing. So, you know, this is a highly vulnerable population, and I think it's incumbent upon our state to find a way to regulate them. I mean, the last time I checked, we regulate hundreds of industries that are far less important. I mean, we actually license dog kennels. We license tattoo artists. We license hill crop adjusters. All those industries are licensed. Now, I think if we can license and inspect dog kennels, I think we can license and inspect assisted living facilities that care for our loved ones.
Commissioner, one of the other things that comes out in Chris's reporting is digging into state records to find how few cases were pursued, how few perpetrators were punished, how few victims and their families were actually made whole through this reporting process that was going on at the Minnesota Department of Health. How do you explain how we got to that situation, but more importantly, I'd say, what you've come in to try to do to change that?
Right. Well, again, I just want to take a moment to thank Chris for his work again and raising, helping to raise awareness of the importance of these issues and putting really the human stories behind the numbers. And it's just been a really important part, I think, of getting this conversation really to be more robust in Minnesota and more centered on
more
the human
urgent,
beings,
yeah,
more urgent. So I want to just acknowledge and thank him for that. Yes, the issue of the backlogs that had piled up in the reports coming into MDH, Chris pointed out in his reporting, and I'll just reiterate here, we just saw a tremendous increase in the number of complaints coming into the Office of Health Facility Complaints, which is one unit within mm-hmm. the Minnesota Department of Health. So those numbers just have really, really skyrocketed.
The reporting and since you've come in,
over a longer period of time, we were seeing about 4,000 complaints per year back in 2010. Mm-hmm. And last year, it was over 25,000. This year, probably we're on pace for a similar number. So the number of complaints have skyrocketed. What had some of the problems that we have to acknowledge and fix within our part of this process was our failure to keep up with that volume. We had not only not enough staffing, but really kind of out-of-date, inadequate systems for how we handle these complaints, paper-based records, not an electronic process to help us keep track of what was where. So the what problems that Chris uncovered were that we had literally at the beginning of 2017 over 2,300 complaints that had not been assessed. So that was a very concerning backlog. I'm happy to say that backlog of cases has now been completely worked through.
Mm-hmm.
He also points out that a relatively small percentage of those cases those complaints that are filed end up being investigated by an on-site investigator. That doesn't mean nothing is done with those cases, but whether they meet the state definitions of abuse and neglect, which the State Vulnerable Adults Act spells out, is kind of this front-end process involves first looking to see, are we the right regulatory authority for this particular complaint? And sometimes it's actually a county adult protection
issue.
As
in, who would be the best to investigate this?
Exactly.
Right?
Sometimes it doesn't fit our jurisdiction, and that's part of the problem, although I would want to make sure your listeners are aware of a resource to help with that as well. Which is the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, mm-hmm. which is designed to be, and this is relatively new within the last 5 or 6 years, designed to be the single point of entry for all kinds of complaints dealing with adult abuse, so that folks can call the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, or MARC as it is known. We can give that phone number right now, if you'd like,
sure,
and
go
certainly
ahead, Commissioner. Yeah.
Post it. But MARC, as it's known, the phone number for MARC toll free is 844-880-1574. And so the important, I want to kind of really stress this because it's so key to making the system work better.
Mm-hmm.
So if all the calls from all kinds of places come into MARC, that system is set up to say, is this a law enforcement issue? Is this a county adult protection issue? Is this an issue for the health department? So they're in the best position to get something to the proper jurisdiction, if you will, to start that investigatory process. So that it's really helpful when people use that common intake point, because it helps to get things to the right place first.
And again, the number is 844-880-1574. Chris, if I might, what also emerged in your reporting was maybe this is the result of feeling overwhelmed, but a lot of these cases were just the paperwork thrown away, ignored. I think you quoted, Nancy Fitzsimmons from Minnesota State University Mankato, who said, "It's painful to think about how many of these criminals are getting off the hook because we're sending these cases down an administrative black hole." What is your sense about how we got to that point? Is it just the sheer numbers? The agency just couldn't handle it?
Well, I think that, the commissioner just explained, that problem has essentially been fixed. They've done tremendous work since late last year in cleaning up that huge backlog, which really did have a huge effect. I mean, we talk about it as if it's just a pile of paperwork, but it really had a major impact on families because, if they had reported, let's say, an assault, a robbery in a facility, then they would often end up waiting a year or longer to get some kind
of
conclusion. And, we interviewed families that had waited as long as 2 years to get some sort of resolution. And so, during that waiting period, they don't really know if the facility is safe. They're obviously going through a great deal of trauma. And so by cleaning up that backlog, expediting the investigative process, the Department of Health has made a huge step forward in terms of restoring public confidence in our state's ability to respond to these cases. And I don't think that should be understated. I think that was an important monumental thing to accomplish. And essentially they've eliminated the backlog. I would say that, just in talking to families, that they have noticed a dramatic improvement in terms of, the state reaching out to them, giving them more frequent updates as far as, the status of the investigations. And I think that communication is really, really important because it really wasn't there, a year ago. So I think these are all dramatic improvements. That being said, I do think that, we still have cases where you know, people will report horrific things happening, even sexual assaults, and facilities will keep them in the dark. They still don't have a legal obligation to tell them what happened. And so that was something that, you know, I think that, you know, advocates and many of the families had hoped would be addressed in the legislation this session that didn't pass. And I think they're going to push for next year.
Chris Sears is with us. If you've just tuned in, he is a reporter for the Star Tribune and wrote the series about which we're talking about which there was a lot of attention at the state capitol and ultimately the creation of some legislation that in the end didn't pass, got caught up in some politics there at the end of the session. We've also have Minnesota Health Department Commissioner Jan Malcolm in the studio to talk about some of the changes that have been made in the wake of the series and increased awareness around elder abuse and reporting. And are some of the things we're tackling this morning, how can you be assured that the facility or the healthcare employees that you're bringing in to help care for a loved one, whether somebody who is dealing with Alzheimer's, somebody who needs home health care for some time, somebody who is considering going into a nursing home or assisted living, what are the kinds of questions you should be asking? And how can you be assured that you're getting the highest quality and the safest care for your aging loved one? So if you have questions about that, what do you think the most difficult challenge is as you face a decision about care, a place to go, the kind of health care that you want to bring in for your loved one? What are the most difficult challenges in trying to figure that out? Because it can be difficult to work your way through the maze. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Call here from Carol in Plymouth. Carol, it sounds like you work in the industry. I'm glad you called.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What's your experience with this? What are you thinking about?
Well, you know, it's really frustrating for me. I have to do a lot of hiring for the aides that take care of my seniors, and the process is kind of a nightmare. I call places that they say they've previously worked, and they'll just give me their dates of hire. They won't tell me if they're rehirable. Mm. They won't tell me if they had an incident. And I think that really, if you really want to get into where the problem roots from, is I think that problem. That's the root cause of not being able. I think that if you're a caregiver, there should be a registry. And if something came up, if you were sleeping on the job, if you were giving meds incorrectly, if you were neglectful, I think there needs to be a better system in place for that. Because it's really frustrating trying to find good people to take care of the seniors.
This is a really good point, because you'd want to know the background of the person who's going to spend, I don't know, 12 or 16 hours with your loved one, Commissioner. How can you be assured about the quality of the people that you're bringing in?
Yeah, Carol raises a really good point. And there are significant workforce challenges already today.
Mm-hmm.
And
shortages.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's only, you know, going to become a bigger challenge as we have more and more of us aging and more needs for care.
Is this because of the pay primarily?
Pay is a big issue, for sure. And these are difficult jobs, not very glamorous jobs. The pay is not commensurate with, in many ways, the trust and the responsibility that we're putting on these folks. The hiring question is a really good one. If something doesn't rise to the level of a criminal action, Carol's right to say we don't have a good system for keeping track of that. There are workers' rights and all kinds of complicating issues, but we need to keep discussing this. How can we build a better system for helping facilities with that all-important hiring process? Can that be a voluntary effort? Can we share data on a voluntary basis? Does it need to be statutory? What kind of protections need to exist around the data around that? But it's a very fair point.
Chris, did your reporting shed any light on this, on how families can make sure that the people who are attending to their aging loved ones are the best they can find?
Well, I do think that it would be helpful if more of this information about abuse and neglect and investigations were put online in a easy to find format. I mean, it's there. You can find state inspections of assisted living facilities, but it's confusing. In many cases, it's, you know, the inspections are done under the names of entities that provide the services as opposed to the facilities themselves. So it's really difficult for folks searching for a place for their loved one to actually find up-to-date information about the health and safety of these facilities. So I think as one step, it would be really helpful if that information were online and easy to access. I mean, I sometimes joke, but I think it's true. It's easier to find information about, you know, the quality of area pizza restaurants sometimes than it is assisted living. You know, you can go on Yelp and find all kinds of information, but when it comes to these facilities that take care of our loved ones, that information is often very much in short supply. The only thing I would also say is that, you know, when interviewing, you know, dozens of families all over the state, and, you know, and this isn't meant as a criticism or anything, it's just sometimes these facilities, when they market themselves, they market their services, their buildings. So when people go in and they take a tour, you know, they show them the chandeliers and the fitness rooms and the hair salons. And I do think that sometimes, you know, that creates this impression that, you know, that there must be good quality of care. And I would just say that, you know, I've gone on some of these tours that the focus of the tour should really be about the people, the care. And that's really what folks should be focused on. Quality of care.
Yeah, Chris, I mean, what you're saying is really important here. Let me follow up for a minute. When you're going, I did this with my mother for her husband. I went on some tours of some facilities, and yes, you're kind of dazzled by the, as you say, the fitness rooms and the beautiful lobbies and all that. What is your sense, Chris, from having reported on this, of the questions you should be asking and the things you ought to be looking for on one of those, you know, initial experiences in these places?
Well, you know, my family went through this process too, you know, so I've been through this, and you just, you know, you think about, well, daily, what kind of care would be provided, and you ask specific questions. Well, you know, here are the symptoms that, you know, my loved one has, and how would you deal with this particular situation? You create scenarios, you ask them pointed questions, and you ask them of the caregivers and the staff and not the marketing person. You know, a lot of these big facilities have marketing staff, and they're there to give tours and hand you glossy brochures. But those people are, I don't mean to make across-the-board statements that they're all not familiar with the care, but many of them aren't really familiar with nursing care. So I think it's just really important, you know, I would just say this from personal experience, to really have direct communications with the people that actually work there.
Commissioner, what would you add to that?
Boy, I would sure agree, and count me in too. I've had the same family experience and was the consumer trying to sort this through under the duress of a short time frame. And now I'm learning so much about what I didn't know to ask as a family member. I think Chris pointed out the importance of really asking the questions about the care. Like when I was finding a place for my family member, I didn't ask, you know, the facility owner, do you employ the care providers? If you don't, who does? Who do I need to know? Who do I need to know about in terms of who's going to actually provide the care services? I would suggest, too, that a couple of resources that are really helpful, because finding that right match for what your loved one needs and where those services are. The area agencies on aging all around our state are great resources. That depends on, you know, where you are in the state, but you can look up your local area agency on aging. They're great resources. So is the Senior Linkage Line, which is a really good and free resource for folks to get plugged into. How do I look for home care? What do I know about home care in my area? So they too are a great resource. And if folks have can jot this down. Senior Linkage Line is 800-333. My eyes are failing me.
2433.
Thank you, Carrie.
And seniorlinkageageline.com.
Yes.
Right? To find that. Is that a clearinghouse for, I mean, could you call and say, I'm considering these three different nursing homes or assisted living facilities. What do you know about them? I mean, can you be that general and get detailed information?
I think they would vary in the amount of detail that they would have to give you, but they can help you understand the distinctions between the types of facilities, what quality ratings there may be, Better Business Bureau reports, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they can sure help you with the questions to ask. One of the things we're working on, and I hope we can come back to, so what are we doing since the legislation didn't pass, but this notion of an assisted living report card,
okay,
picking up on Chris's points of how do we make it easier for people to get access to what is knowable about histories of quality complaints in these facilities. So we're working to try to, with consumer groups and with the industry, who also I think has an interest in making sure that consumers can get at better information to help them make a choice.
Call here from Barry in St. Paul. Hey, Barry, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, thanks for having me.
Uh-huh.
So I'd like to first thank your two guests for making the distinction between ALFs and skilled nursing facilities.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, as they've said over and over again, it's a really important distinction. And as they said, skilled nursing facilities are highly regulated. I think they're the second highly regulated industry in the United States, whereas ALFs, not the same. So people shouldn't confuse those two. I know there's plenty of regulation in the skilled nursing facilities. The other thing I would like to say is, my nursing assistants and my nurses are great. There's no problem with them.
Mm-hmm.
They get paid. They hardly get paid. The nursing assistants who do the bulk of the work get paid about $13 an hour. They can go out to Aldi's and get a better job. They work really hard. They show tremendous care for our residents.
Mm-hmm.
And then I hear an earlier caller giving them a hard time and saying, care for our loved ones and our vulnerable adults. Oh, it's the problem of lazy nursing assistants and nurses. It's not. The problem is with the people with the money. They don't spend the money for resources to take care of our people.
Let me take this back to our guests here, Barry. Chris, what did you find about I guess the quality of applicants and the pay and how that influences who does this work? And then what about what Barry is saying about the facilities themselves don't want to spend the money on this?
Well, I mean, I definitely would agree with what Barry said. I think it would be wrong to lay the blame of, for what's happening with the staff in these facilities. I think that would be a wrong conclusion, that the increase in maltreatment reports are the result of some sort of problem with the caregivers in these facilities. I don't think that's the case at all. I do think that, we interviewed, people that work in assisted living facilities that were under, an incredible amount of stress and, in some cases, working overnight shifts where they, had to care for upwards of 60 people, just one person.
Wow.
And so it was literally physically impossible for them to get to everyone during that shift. And so they, they were very tortured by that. They felt guilty by that, about that. And the absence of any kind of, minimum ratios in assisted living for staffing, I think is one problem. So that I think is contributing to some extent to this problem that, mm-hmm. Yes, people are understaffed. These facilities are understaffed. But, some of these companies that run these facilities, are making immense profits. So I have a hard time putting the blame at the foot of the workers.
What do you do, Commissioner, about the fact that these are for-profit companies, many of them that are running these businesses? I'm not saying that means that they intentionally scrimp at every facility, but what do you do about requiring that they maintain a certain quality and that it isn't really all about profit?
Right. Well, I think something to keep our eye on, that we have seen, and I don't know off the top of my head what the breakdown is between nonprofit and for-profit operators in our state. I know that there are a lot of both, but mm-hmm. we have seen a trend with national real estate investment trusts buying up senior living facilities nationwide and kind of converting from what had been community-based, locally owned care facilities into national chains. Not to say there's anything per se wrong with that, but it does raise the questions about how connected are they to the community? What are their kind of operating values and principles? We think we should keep a closer eye on transfers of ownership of that nature, so that we're tracking what happens when the ownership of the facilities changes hands. Is that an occasion or an opportunity for us to, to go in there perhaps a little more frequently or earlier, just to kind of establish our expectations about the fact that we'll be collecting data and trying to use it in a more proactive way. Mm-hmm. But I think it goes back to this notion of it's important to have a regulatory framework that makes care expectations more explicit. Chris mentioned that the importance of having trained people doing dementia care. That's another area where the statutory framework is inadequate. One thing we were pushing for and we'll push for again is more standards around dementia care units. What does that mean? What should be the training and the qualifications of people providing that level of care? So we have to keep working on the statutory framework. We should do a better job and are working to do that, to take a hold of the information we already have and figure out how to use that more proactively and mm-hmm. to support consumers and providers who want to improve.
Commissioner Jan Malcolm in the studio with me, Chris Sears on the phone line, a Star Tribune reporter that wrote about elder abuse and care. We're looking at some of the changes that the commissioner has made since she came into the Minnesota Health Department and some of the issues that Chris highlighted in the series, and then asking you this morning, as a caregiver, as someone who is maybe beginning the process of looking for a place for your aging loved one, maybe someone who in your family who has dementia, and you're starting to say, what kind of facility, what kind of help are we going to need? Where do I begin? I think we can give you some advice on that. What are some of the greatest challenges in that? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. And you can also reach me on Twitter. I will tweet out some of the phone numbers and the websites here. The commissioner came in with some good key contacts here. So I'll share that with you via Twitter. We continue our conversation now with Chris Sears from the Star Trib and Jan Malcolm, commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. To the phones to Krista in Eden Prairie. Hey, Krista, thanks so much for waiting. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. Tell me what you want to add to the discussion and how you come into this conversation.
I'm a director of Supportive Living Services, mm-hmm. Which is for adults with developmental disabilities, many of which are under the same policies and laws that the population is that you're talking about. And I just wanted to add that this is such a multifaceted issue, and it really comes back to how we value the staff and the policies that we support in paying for these services. So many people don't even realize that we just received a 7% cut in services, and there are so many smaller agencies that are going to be so severely affected by this that they're probably going to fall apart. I'm fortunate in that the fact that I work for a very large organization that's able to continue to support what we do, but while it is a multifaceted issue, I think one of the most key things is the policies and the way that we view the people who support our elderly people and our people with disabilities. If we're going to pay them $12 an hour, how much can we expect from somebody for $12 an hour? That's not even a living wage. And we're continuously cutting these budgets for services.
I'm really glad you heard the show, Kristen. You had a chance to call in. Commissioner, how much can you really do about the pay scale, as committed as you are to this issue, about the pay scale of employees in the system?
Yep. Well, thanks, Krista. And I'm awfully glad, too, that you reminded us that this is not just about elders, but vulnerable adults more broadly, and certainly couldn't agree more with that. I think, what can we do? I mean, this is a societal choice that we make. I mean, the legislature ultimately makes these funding decisions, but it's incumbent on all of us who know and care about this issue to be pointing out to our legislators what the real world consequences are of our failure to invest in the workforce and making cuts in the waiver services that Chris is talking about, and the, you know, the impact on real people that that has. So it's fundamentally all tied up in these bigger questions about, you know, kind of what we value and how we express that in how we fund social services and medical care for vulnerable populations. So it's certainly a call for citizens to be informed about those issues and to weigh in and engage with their legislators.
Chris, I just wanted to run something by you. I was reading some of the things that Elder Justice, which is one of the resources that the commissioner brought with her today, and I know you talked to them and did some reporting on that. When I read what they say about who these perpetrators sometimes are, I have to say it's pretty hair-raising. I mean, family members, they say new best friends or sweethearts, religious leaders, neighbors. I mean, this feels pretty threatening without exaggerating this. What were the families saying to you about this?
Well, you know, it was really the families that really brought this issue to the forefront. You know, about 2 years ago, there was a group of families called Elder Voice Family Advocates, and a number of them had experienced some pretty horrific incidents of maltreatment, and they started to have meetings and to share information and get organized around this. And, you know, it takes a lot of energy and a lot of courage to tell your story.
Absolutely.
When it involves a loved one, when it involves your parent who's been sexually assaulted, and it's not easy to stand alone and do that on your own. So when Elder Voice came together, that was a huge, huge breakthrough. It was monumental. I mean, they were the only organization that was really focused on this issue. And so they started to assemble their stories and get out in the communities and tell those stories. They talked to us, they talked to other media, and it was really their efforts that kind of tilled the soil. I mean, they really sort of tilled the soil that then created, you know, the broader awareness and the tremendous gains that have occurred at the Department of Health. But, you know, it is harrowing when you find out who does this, you know, and in many cases it's, you know, in these facilities, it's the person, you know, in the same room, the person down the hall. And it's just really important to keep in mind that, you know, you really have to watch your loved one like a hawk.
Is that something, Commissioner, we've all shared today, you, me, and Chris, that we've been through this with our families. I don't know that that's something, I'm not sure how I would find out about what's going on in a facility like Chris was referring to. Mm-hmm. Do you?
Well, you know, I think there is more we can do with the information that we have. I mean, we talked earlier in the show about I guess you can take some comfort from the fact that it's a fairly small percentage of the complaints that are filed that actually end up as substantiated cases of abuse or neglect. However, we've got tremendous data on all those other experiences that are important. Mm-hmm. They may not meet the state definitions of abuse or neglect, but they speak to important experiences and opportunities to improve quality and support healthy aging for our vulnerable adults and elders. So we can do more with the data we have, and we're committed to working on that. I think this other issue you raised about what Elder Justice has taught us about the prevalence of this issue. We've been talking about facilities, and it's right and good that we make sure we update our regulations and that we regulate appropriately. But the fact that this is a rampant problem in every community, happens in communities, happens in homes, it's a bigger issue than we know, is a vast societal challenge that we need to get our heads and our hearts around, that we need to figure out what's going on, what's creating all these stressors and all these risk factors for people to experience some form of abuse and neglect, and really turn our attention not only to regulating competently, but to working harder on prevention at the front end.
Call here from Denise in Edina. Denise, it sounds like you've been through this, looking for a place for a family member. Yes?
I have, yes. And I must say, I have never, ever called into NPR in my life, but I feel very strongly about this issue, so I did so
today. I'm glad you did. Yeah, what was your experience like?
So what I did is early in my mom's diagnosis, when she first was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, and it looked like down the road maybe she would need a facility, I started looking early. First in my neighborhood, I thought as close as possible to me, but then I started asking everybody I knew, my beautician, my, you know, just hardware store people, have you had this experience? And I ended up picking a facility from one of these people. Then I started visiting first with the marketing people, then at non-peak hours, like I would go visit 9 o'clock p.m. on a Friday, just check it out. And they would let me in, and I would get to talk to the real workers. How long have you worked here? What do you like best about working here? And then I would go back and back. And weekends, I would just show up on a weekend. I'm taking a tour by myself, and I got the most information there. I really wanted to know how long they worked there. And the same people were still there 6 months after I started looking. So I thought, that's what I'm going to do. But then I asked the marketing people for the phone numbers of two people who have their loved ones there, preferably like a daughter and then a spouse.
Good job.
And I called them. They were willing. And then I called them. I took them out for coffee. And then I met them again at the facility with their loved one and hung out a while. And so I think I was probably kind of a pain in the butt for this facility. But eventually, and it was almost a year later, then my mom needed to be in care, and I already knew this is where I was going to be. Even it was not the closest to where I live, it's the one I felt.
You had a lot of confidence, but you've really impressed the commissioner here. Commissioner?
Really? Oh,
wow. Thank you so much for that call, Denise. And what an incredible level of due diligence you did. That is just tremendous. I wish for all of us that we had an advocate that dedicated. That was a great job on your part.
What do you think about this idea, though, to come back to just practical things you can do? Showing up at the facility at non-peak times. I mean, really getting to know the people that are working there.
I think it goes so well with what we've been talking about, the importance of the actual caregivers, developing relationships with them, both on the front end, trying to assess how they feel about their work, how you feel about even can you figure out who's responsible for the care. But then if your loved one is in a facility, trying to have relationships with those caregivers, and don't hesitate to talk to the facility owners if you're concerned about something. And if you see abuse or neglect, please do report it to the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center. The sooner that people register their concerns, the more likely we are to be able to help try to head something off before it becomes too serious.
Hey, Chris, thank you so much for the time today and for letting us dig in more to your reporting. Appreciate that.
Thank you for helping to raise awareness. Thank you so much.
Commissioner Malcolm, I know you're a busy woman. Thank you for the time today. Good to have you.
Thank you.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.